goodness.
Do you really want me to this detail?
If you've got me wound up. If you're willing to continue, we might as well.
You know, in fact, I have told a number of people that someday I ought to make a tape recording of my wartime experience before I get too many of these mental blanks. And this is the first time I've opened up in this kind of detail on things. I've left out an awful lot to shorten this, but
please continue as long as you feel you want.
It turned out that at the Zoroastrian Society, Finch had a talk that he wanted to give first. And it went on and on and on and on. And it got closing time. And finally, Finch said that we have a visitor from America who also has something to say today. So, at closing time, he allowed the visitor who'd come from America to tell him the story to get on the platform and talk. And I said there was one moot point about tests. A lot of the bombs had hit rafters above the above the tiles, and when they hit a rafter, they couldn't go through. They bounced off and slid out. And when you had a broken tile over a rafter and a bomb on the ground, that bomb was unfortunate, and we corrected out those bombs that were hit over rafters. But the identification of that hitting was done largely by Standard Oil. And the number of bombs we threw out, the number of cases we threw out, was larger than the number you would expect by probability considerations would hit over a rafter. And I told this story in honesty to the British. Among the mathematicians was Fisher, the famous Fisher of statistics, and Bronowski, Jacob Bronowski, whom I later got to know well, was there, and somebody said, I hadn't said this number was larger than the probability consideration, but I'd given them the data, and they saw that it was larger. I had told them about the fact that we had subtracted them, but I hadn't told them, and the number we subtracted was larger than you'd expect statistically. Somebody asked that question. Somebody else said we ought to ask Dr. Bronowski on that. So he got up and held forth, and the conclusion was that we had thrown out more tests than we should. And I said, but you're not really arguing about statistics here. You're arguing about facts. You use statistics when you don't have the data, but we had the data. And whether they believed it, whether they thought that data taken by Standard Oil was fair data or not, I don't know, but that was behind it, I'm afraid, behind it, whether somebody had fudged the data. I had the data, but did I have data that was really data? I thought I did have. I skipped the fact that our arguments about the assessment during the test. I said I was chairman of the assessment group, and we took a couple of hours after the test was over, and then would come back after supper and continue, and where there was a moot point, we tried hard to get a good consensus and put on the strength of our assessment. I had, after taking a little of their time, said it's late, I don't know whether to go on. They encouraged me to go on. It was on a number of them. I later found, thought Finch had been very ugly in using up the afternoon when a supposedly distinguished guest was there to tell him something. I'll have to come back to Finch. Well, Myers and I were the two who went to England on that trip. And we talked to the Royal Air Force. We did not ever sell the M69 bomb. They were sold on their magnesium bomb and stayed with it and never dropped a 69 in Europe. There was, meanwhile, an argument between our bomb and the Finch bomb. Finch himself had developed a bomb. Ours was 5 or 6 pounds, and you dropped many of them. His was 45 pounds, and it was nothing but a traveling oil burner. Motor-driven oil burner with air and we thought it was kind of foolish, and he thought it was the only thing. And I remember in a discussion he had with one of the military people about the desirability of making a movie of incendiary warfare, Finch outlined the scenario. And the scenario was to start with Finch in a chair, the expert on fire, telling them how to build a bomb. And then they would have tests on his bomb. I saw some of the tests on his bomb in structures in Stradling's Building Research Division. Stradling was head of building research, and they had lent the bomb group use of buildings research facilities for tests. I had seen Finch's bomb, and Finch's story about our bomb was that it had been tested in bone dry territory out in Utah, where it was easy to set fires, and London was very wet, and England Japan was very humid, and London was a better simulation of Tokyo than Dugway Proving Ground was, and you needed something as potent as his bomb to start fires. This caused us later to set up a program that involved people traipsing through other people's bedrooms in Key West, Florida at night to weigh the wood that they had hanging to see how its moisture content was going on. And we had two Englishmen from London in this thing in connection with determining what the effect of moisture on setting bombs was. And we built a great cabinet at Edgewood Arsenal where we conditioned wood, and we built simulated Japanese rooms with wood of exactly known moisture content. So we...
Was there much of an effect on the M69?
Yes, there was an effect, but it was a good bomb in wet weather. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Finch was dead set on its being the right bomb, and did everything he could to block any effects we had. Whether he had any effect or whether they just wanted to stay with their magnesium bomb, I don't know. They didn't ever go to the Finch bomb. And I'll jump ahead and say that when 6 months later Finch had become president of the Royal Society and came to America, I took him to General Montgomery, the Air Force chemical officer, and he started to hold force on this British bomb that the Americans should have. And the only British bomb he described was the Finch bomb and not the British bomb that the British were using. And I said, General Montgomery, I have to be impolite and interrupt and tell you that this bomb of Dr. Finch's is not in production. It's his own bomb. And Finch got quite mad at me for the interruption. But I couldn't. Finch was misrepresenting to Montgomery. Montgomery had the same name as a British general, but this was an American chemical officer who had been put over to the Air Force, and he became the air chemical officer in the Air Force. And he sort of passed on the bombs that the Air Corps got from the chemical corps.
How long did you stay in England?
I stayed in England until about January 10th. We'd come over on the Pan American Clipper on different clippers. Mine had got stuck in the Azores for a week. And Myers had got stuck for 10 days at Bermuda. And when we came back, we thought, well, we'll go the southern route to Brazil and over. Yellow fever in the big Brazilian city that's grown so fast. That's awful. Another name, a place I'll remember anyway. You couldn't go there unless you had a yellow fever shot, and we didn't have. So we settled for coming back on the Mauritania. We had come by plane. We thought, well, we could go back on a 4-day boat faster than we could go by plane, the way planes were going. Mauritania. I'm going to continue to be long-winded and tell you the story. On the Mauritania, you were not allowed to know where you were. There were no bulletins. You knew clock time relative to Greenwich. That's all you knew. There were a lot of technical people. I suggested to my roommate that we see what we could do about finding out where we were. And I thought that we could build something that would tell us about where we were. And he was willing. I rolled up, I made my idea of a sextant out of tubes of paper wrapped up. And at the one that was at the base of the triangle, I put up a pen with a large round glass ball on it, so I could stick the ball of the pen at the center of rotation of my eye. I didn't have any mirrors. And I flip my eye back and forth between the sun and the horizon and move this thing. I had a cross piece here until that pin was on the horizon, that pin was on the sun, and the glass ball was at the center of rotation of my eye. And we had no ephemeris, no nautical almanac. And I said, we can put on the 21st of December, it's winter solstice, and I'll use that 23 and a half degrees and a sine curve, and that way I'll decide about what the declination of the sun is today instead of, it's not now December 21st and we have no tables. It turned out that was awfully good. I didn't know how good it was at the time. And we got nothing else but getting the altitude of the sun at noon. And knowing the altitude would give us our latitude, if we know it's noon. And knowing the time at which the altitude was a maximum, we'll know our longitude because we know Greenwich time. Our accuracy on altitude will be pretty fair, but the sun goes through that kind of a path, and where its peak is pretty poor. So we might know where we are latitude-wise, 10 or 15 miles. The other way, we might be off 100 miles. But anyway, that's that much more information than anybody else has, and we'll do it. The ship was full of military people being sent to Canada for Green Beret training. You know the cut-and-slash night tactics. I forget. I'm trying to think of the word they use for that kind of troops. Anyway, they were being sent to Canada for that kind of training, a lot of them. And so the ship had a lot of military people on it, in the military part, and a few scientists and diplomats in the other part. And we had a lot of people watching us when we would take our shots up where the military were. And we got our little bulletin out to people we knew saying where we were, and in 2 more days we'd hit New York. The next day we got out. This wasn't a quick shot. This was 2 hours of work on either side of noon. That's all we could do with this crude gadget. And the next day, we were 300 miles north of where we'd been before. No, south of where we'd been before. And no nearer New York, in fact, a little further from New York than before, according to our bulletin. Well, everybody lost confidence in us, these guys. We thought they knew something about it, but obviously they don't. Well, it was 10 days before the ship got into port. I knew that we'd sailed north when we left Liverpool. And I knew we'd done some south sailing, but I hadn't really kept track of that. I just knew that our 2 days of sighting had been disappointing. Then there was a little article in the Boston papers about so long in February, about on such and such a date, and they named dates that bracketed our trip, a German submarine fleet caused major diversion of traffic between England and America, and the ships generally went up almost to Iceland and then straight south of Bermuda and then back up north again. And we'd been right, only it just didn't seem right when we did it. So that was my first experience with a self-made extant.
Amazing.
Well, goodness, that's really a digression. Now, where was I? We didn't have too much influence on the British. They took us down to where Garner had made his installation of oil to prevent the Germans from landing, and now we were using it to study how we could land if the Germans used oil to keep us from landing, because the south of England was packed with stuff from America that was ready to go for the invasion. It was January, and they'd been piling stuff for months, and the beaches were full. We went to Brighton and then down to Southampton, Bournemouth, and The Isle of Purbeck is where our experiments were, where Garner's installation was that I guess got him the OBE. Garner was with us on that trip. He was also a specialist on botany, president of the English Botanical Society of Great Britain, and an expert on ilex and the holly of the Isle of Purbeck was absolutely gorgeous, and Fred Garner knew the different ones. When I came back, I spent several years growing ilex, and he visited me in my home in Winchester later in the war, and we saw a lot of each other after the war. I visited him in Birmingham, and my wife and I stayed at his home in Birmingham, and we saw him in Berkeley, California years later. We saw a lot of Garner over the years. Grand man, head of chem engineering at Birmingham, which was then the number one chemical engineering university in England, no doubt about it. Well, I've gotten pretty much
when was it that you came back then? That was in
I came
40.
Back about since January and in 44, and continued in the war effort until the armistice. And
did you continue doing any more testing after that point, or was your testing pretty well?
Right up until the war absolutely ended, we kept going full steam as though it was never going to happen. And I should say that I had Q clearance, that was the nuclear clearance, and I also had top secret clearance. But Q clearance, in those days, you didn't get told any more than you needed to know, and I had no more. Wait a minute, I beg your pardon. I did not have Q clearance during the war. It was after the war that I got Q clearance. I'm sorry, that was wrong. I had only top secret clearance, and I didn't know when the Los Alamos thing was going to happen. And it happened while Rex Adams, the Chemical Corps colonel who wrote the report with me on what the Chemical Corps should do with the M-57-8 bombs so they wouldn't be dropped, M-57, that happened. And my top secret clearance had given me damage reports on the cities of Japan, and we had lists of the targets and knew about what the plans were, not any details of the plans. The Air Force never told us in advance what they were really going to do. I don't know whether that was decided in Japan or in America, but anyway, they dropped more bombs than they needed in most places. But we did get air cover photographs and damage reports, and we knew that all of the major cities of Japan had been destroyed by fire, that 120,000 lives had been lost in Tokyo, and about the same area destroyed as in the fire and earthquake of 23. Here was a city, Hiroshima, that was ripe for bombing, and we weren't to bomb it. I didn't know why. I should have put two and two together, but I didn't. I don't remember whether I knew about Nagasaki or not. But Ed Moreland, MIT's vice president, had gone to Japan to see what was... not to Japan. He went to Japan right after the armistice, after the war, to check up on some things. And he came back and told me that it was quite clear that although the Japanese officers out in the field on the fleets and so on didn't know the situation of the homeland, Japan, the homeland, was just ready to surrender. And I've always thought that the big bomb needn't have been dropped. If they'd gone and dropped it up on Hokkaido somewhere, the northern island, and said, watch what could happen unless you surrender, we could be a world without ever having had a bomb drop on people. Anyway, fire had pretty well destroyed Japan, and we had the clear evidence of it. It wasn't all the M-69 bomb. There was a large M-70. I think the M-75. I'm not sure of those numbers any longer, but it was a 40-something pound bomb that we had studied the dispersion of out on one of the Harvard athletic fields. We set a tower up in the middle of the field and flooded the field with ice and set off a bomb and established the distribution of gobs. Louis Fieser is the one who'd arranged that test. That was a test on napalm, whether it dispersed properly. A lot of crazy tests, John.
It's amazing you would do that right in the middle of the city.
Where else? It was flat, you see. You didn't have to have but a few inches of ice on the field.
Did you continue this work right up then?
Right up the end of the war. And then,
did that group disband after the war ended?
Sure, right away. It's amazing how fast people wanted to get out. They were fed up on war. Well, I was so saturated with fire as a weapon of destruction that when I was asked to be on a peacetime fire research committee by the Army, I was happy to say yes. And when the Academy of Sciences set up its fire research committee, I became its first chairman, and it was an activity that was intensive enough so that I had an executive officer in Washington, Dan Thornhill, who he had a few other chores, but two-thirds of his time was spent as executive officer on my fire committee, and we even got to the point of getting out a fire research journal, which was edited at Johns Hopkins. Oh boy, is that awful that I get a blank on the name of the very important man at Hopkins who was the editor of that for. Oh goodness, that's, I've got to fix that. That must never go in print that I don't know that, because that was central to my activity.
Well, we can fill that in. That's
two of them in succession, both from Hopkins, both from the ABL, Allegheny Ballistics Laboratory, that had done rocket work during the war.
Well, you did some work on turbines back even before the war, didn't you? There was a turbine committee at MIT.
Yes. I had uh, Soderbergh was head of the mechanical engineering department, and wanted to increase the gas turbine research effort, and got an interdepartmental committee set up, and I was the chemical engineering member of that committee. We had no laboratory, no money, just a committee. And I don't remember how the first money was got. Soderbergh must have got it from MIT, but I don't remember that. I told you I'm not as a promoter, and I hadn't tried to get any money, but he had, and he'd gotten it. And what he decided, or the committee decided, was that the first work would be done on combustion under my direction in the mechanical engineering department on a compressor they had that would serve after a fashion to get going. And had a thesis man who started work on that. Boy, I've forgotten his name.